Once you're older, you'll appreciate it. Or we can do something like this. This is actually from a devotions I've used fairly often in various settings. I'm just going to read a few verses from Psalm 139 for the sake of time. The first four verses say, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path in my lying down and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. And then make that come alive for the students by saying, do you know that God knows everything about you? That the Lord sees everything you do? Did you know that when you get up and when you sit down, God sees that? I know it's by downsitting and by uprising, that's what I'm referring to. How many of you know what you're going to be thinking about tomorrow night at 4:12? Any hands? Nobody knows what they're going to be thinking about at 4:12 on August the 7th. Or is it? No, tomorrow's the 8th, sorry. Well, did you know that God knows what you're going to be thinking about? Thou understandest my thought afar off? Make it come alive. And then I like to talk about Psalm 139 and those aspects of it, and then follow it up with a story about a snake that got away with stealing eggs from an African hut for a while until the owner caught on and saw what was happening. This snake was actually stealing the eggs right off of the chicken's nest, which was inside this poor native hut. And so the owner got smart and hard-boiled an egg and quickly swapped eggs the next day. And the snake was caught because he couldn't slip out of the hole he had been using to get in and out. Devotions ought to be something that is inspiring, something that is relatable to the age groups that we're talking to, and something that gets them off to a good start. You know, when we're having devotions, there are no grades. There are no slow learners. There are no tests. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't prepare just as much as we would for our other lessons. It's a chance to get everyone off to a good start. And more importantly than that, devotionals are to draw the heart to God. And so make the spiritual become real to your students. Make them alive. Make them inspiring. Make them practical. Make them enjoyable. I don't believe it's wise for us to try to deal with issues during devotions. Maybe there's been some misbehavior or something like that. I don't believe that devotions is the format to deal with that. Deal with it otherwise. Keep devotions inspiring. It doesn't mean you're not going to step on toes every once in a while when you get into some practical aspects during devotions. I had a student last year who just loved to ask questions. She couldn't wait till she was told anything. She had to ask ahead of time. Mr. Troyer, when are we going to be doing such and such? And it just wasn't time yet to announce it, but she needed to know. Toward the end of the school year, I was having devotions, and I mentioned something about patience and, you know, waiting for our parents to give us information, waiting for the teacher to give us information. She just blushed deep red. I saw it hit home, even though I hadn't meant to target her with what I said. But so we do step on toes sometimes, and that's okay. Encourage discussion. Now, I'm blessed with a classroom of students that love to discuss things, no matter what class we're having. And in devotion, sometimes I get the feeling that they're prolonging a discussion as long as possible so they don't have to get to work. But I'm blessed with that. It shows that they're entering into what we're discussing and so on. Fit devotionals to the age level. For young students in particular, you can start with very simple things. The Bible in Pictures for Little Eyes, I believe Christian Light offers that. That's great for first graders, maybe a few grades up. Eager Meyer's Bible Stories, the big fat blue Bible story book. I have fond memories of that from childhood. My parents read that to us when we were just young. And that's good material for teachers. Something I've seen some of my co-teachers do is just bring illustrated stories that teach a good principle, that have a good lesson in them, and page through the book and show that to the students as they teach it. For middle grades, a couple of resources I've used. I taught grades 4 to 6 last year. I'll have 5th and 6th this coming year. But Fruitful Families and the other series by Brother Howard Bean, they're written to be used as family devotionals. for family worship. They make very good, with a little adaptation, they make very good school devotions. The pathway readers have a wealth of good stories in them that you can draw from to illustrate various concepts. For all age levels, tell Bible stories supplying real life details. For example, the Book of Esther, we often focus on Esther. It's fun to pick out some characters that we don't focus on so much, such as Haman, and just go through the story and tell it from Haman's perspective. And it brings out a lot of symptoms and lessons about pride and so on. For upper grades, they might be ready for select Bible studies, particular subjects. There's also the book by Howard Bean, Truth for Godly Youth, and also Discuss Their Questions. Thank you.
How many of you would say incentives are good? Put your hand up. How many of you would say they're bad? Put your hand up. Great. We're on the same page then, because we're going to look a little bit this afternoon about approaching incentives as a good thing. If we're really honest with ourselves, a lot of what we do in life revolves around incentives of some kind. We might not think of them as such, but think about this. Well, first of all, why do we use them? We use them to produce a result in somebody that we want to see. We even read in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10 about an incentive. It says, "For when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat." Talk about an incentive right there. A little person might work for the incentive of a dime if they do a job, or maybe they get to ride their bike, or maybe they get to do something fun. As you get older, generally the incentive gets bigger, and by the time we're adults, one of the incentives that we have for having a job is making money. That's not the only incentive for working, but that is definitely part of our life. Eating involves incentives. You might eat because you know that you'll be hungry later. You might eat because, if you're young, you might eat because mom says if you eat your peas, then you can go outside and ride your bike. You might eat because you're having a meeting with a customer and you know that if you're eating together, it'll make your relationship blossom better. I don't always think about that as incentives, but that's really what it is in a lot of ways. So, if they're good, then it follows naturally that they should be a part of our teaching. Now, it's been proven that when you complete a task, there's these things in your brain that get released that are called endorphins, and it makes you feel good when you complete a task. And so that in itself is an incentive to keep or to repeat that task and do it again, because your endorphins got released and it made you feel good. And when you present your students with opportunities to complete tasks, then they get that good feeling. So a couple ways we want to prepare incentives that will have a positive effect. Prepare incentives that are suitable to your students' abilities. You get to the end of the marking period, you're looking over grades, and you're like, we need to do something here to get everybody going, light a fire under them. You have a range of 94 to 82 on your report cards. Don't go into the next marking period and say, everybody that has a 95 at the end of the next marking period gets to go to have ice cream. That's great for the guy that was at 94, because he can raise his grade up 1 point. But for the guy at 82, that's going to look like a insurmountable obstacle. So pay attention, and it might be better to say, instead of saying everybody that gets to 95, you could say, if you're at 94, you have to put your thing up 1 point. If you're at 82, you have to put it up 3 points or something. Match it to your students' abilities. Prepare incentives that involve a useful reward. Now, I like pizza parties, and I like ice cream, and I like all that fun stuff. But consider doing a reward such as going and raking leaves for an older person, or going and singing at a rest home, or something that's a little bit more helpful to other people around you rather than just gorging yourself on fun stuff. Now, you might get the feeling from your students that, why would we want to work for that? But I think that if you are excited about it and you keep doing it, there is a good feeling about helping someone else, and your students will pick up on that. And it'll teach them a life skill that helps them later. Prepare class incentives. So everybody is working towards a common goal, not just each person working individually. And again, this comes with knowing your students, but try to prepare it in a way that everybody can contribute, and they will get that, they'll get that feeling that they're a part of this thing too. There will be people that can contribute more just because of the way they are made. But I believe that part of our job is drawing the potential out of a student, getting them to live up to their potential. And part of doing that is getting them that feeling of being able to, hey, I'm in this thing too. We're all working at it together. Also, in doing incentives, make sure your students realize that in life they will not always get something fun because they work hard. That's just not the way life is. And if we take them through school always telling them, if you get 100%, you'll get such and such. If we do that, they're not getting prepared for the real world, because there will be times once they get out of school that sometimes just doing the job well is an incentive enough, and it gives you that good feeling. One of the biggest incentives is being motivated yourself. If your students see enthusiasm in your life, then it'll fall in naturally that they will have enthusiasm in their life. God bless you.
Good afternoon. How do you prepare for a test? Now, how many of you had a five-letter word that started with S pop into your mind? Maybe a couple of you. Maybe the word study. When we think of preparing for a test, often we think, well, study for it, right? I have a couple more questions for you. How many of you that have taught like to send home assignments with your students? Here, study this. This is what you need to study for your test. How many of you do that? Just assignments to study. Okay, a few. Those of you that do, how many of you have 100% success when the student comes back the next day? How many of them have actually studied? Does anybody have 100% success? Not much. I taught a group of ninth graders, and my ninth graders would not come back with their work studied. Some of them did better than others, but it's a challenge that I think we all face. We have to somehow get our students to study what they need to study, and many of us teach students that probably don't really have the drive and maybe aren't able to take an assignment home and study it out of the textbook. So we have to come at this from a little different angle. So let's back up to the test, back up from the test to our view of the test. Why are we giving the student this test? There's probably a few different reasons we give tests. We want to see where the student is at. We want to assess the student's achievements. We want a good grade, right? Who doesn't want a good grade? Maybe we want to see how we as the teacher are doing. We as the teachers are doing. How have I brought this point across? And those probably all are good reasons, good views of the test, but I don't think we can get stuck on just one of those. We don't want to just push for a good grade, or we're probably going to do some pretty specific review right off that test, and we'll get the student to get a good grade. We probably don't want to go there. Sometimes we tend to think that the test is an end in itself, but it's not. The test is a means to an end. We want our students to come away from this classroom with knowledge, with skills that are useful throughout all of their life. And a good test grade is not knowledge and skills that are that are useful throughout the rest of their life. Now, don't get me wrong. The test is very useful in figuring out where that student is and whether they have those skills and whether they're achieving what we have laid out for them to learn. So we need to look at how we're looking at this test and what our view of it is. So then as we get into the lessons, we need to teach what we're going to test for. The student won't have a chance if the test isn't related to or isn't about what he has been taught. So have a plan. Probably many of you use tests that are made up already. Go ahead and pull those out at the beginning of the year and figure out what you need to teach. Obviously, it's going to correspond between the test and the textbook, but still, familiarize yourself with what's on that test. A lot of us have very tight class times. We don't have much time to review. So make a plan and get in those 5 or 10 minutes of review every class time. It doesn't always happen, but do your best. And get a little review in every time, and you'll be stacking building blocks one upon another, and you'll get something out of the student at the time of the test. Just a couple little suggestions for those things for review. Make flashcards. Flashcards are a good way to hammer things in. Have older students review with the younger students. They like to do that. That's a good thing as well. Make a little game out of the review. I like to do that with my students. They like that. Make a couple teams. Have them answer questions. Just make it a little more bearable for them, and they won't look at that test quite so unfavorably. So what can you take away from what I just said? I would stress, make a plan. Don't go up to the test day without having looked at the test. That's the easiest way, but easy is not necessarily better. Go ahead and make a plan, decide where I'm going to go, what do I need to cover, and it will work a lot better for you. Thank you.
Preparing for lessons. You rush off 10 minutes after dismissal on Friday and drive across 3 states, beginning a weekend of much activity and little sleep. When you get out of bed on Monday morning, it's an hour before your first class starts. As students start entering the classroom, you're still chewing a granola bar, hoping nobody looks at your hair too closely, and wondering if you can plan your English class in the time it will take for the copier to print the science worksheets. Overbooked weekends, flat tires, inopportune phone calls, missed alarms, forgotten obligations, unexpected visitors, emergency room visits, schedule mix-ups, food poisonings, a cornucopia of calamities will sometimes force you to wing it. But in the certainty of the problem lies a solution. Preparation. Since you know it will happen, you can plan for it. If that sounds familiar to you, perhaps you were reading the weekly emails from the doc. That's where I got that last week, thanks to Peter Gertzen from not so far from here, just north in Clackamas County. This kind of situation ought not to be happening too often. Occasionally, it can be exhilarating. Repeatedly, it's self-defeating and ignorant, the telltale sign that you have not worked long enough at the pizza shop. Back you go for more learning about the rudiments of order and planning and preparation and systems. A few overarching guidelines, first of all. Cultivate order. Prevent the mess. Here are a few ways to cultivate order regarding preparing for lessons. Have well-established daily routines. Give lesson planning a high priority. Prepare lessons before checking. You were hired, after all, to be a teacher, not a checker. although teachers do check. Warren Buffett says games aren't won by watching the scoreboard. He's right. That ought to be reflected in your daily routine. Another suggestion for establishing a routine about planning, preparing for lessons, is plan by the week or beyond. Not that you study the lesson in depth and peruse the lesson as you will the evening before. But each week, especially if you're a beginning teacher, plan out the next week. You can make adjustments as needed on a daily basis. Another part of establishing daily routines is know when study works best for you. One of you here in attendance has or had an email that said, blah, 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 teachernightowl.com. Wasn't me, because nights are for sleeping for this man. But if nights are not for sleeping for you, that's okay. That's all right. But find what time works best for you. If I want to make some serious mileage in preparing for lessons, I will set the alarm for 4 o'clock or 3:30 or 4:30 or 5, but not 5:30, the normal time, you see what I'm saying. That's when I can knock out some serious work, and that's a routine that I have developed for me. Another part of cultivating order is know what you're up against. Which subjects this year are going to be the easy ones to prepare for? Which ones are going to be the harder ones? What subjects are going to be easier for the students, harder for the students? How much time will it take me to prepare for lessons? Know what you're up against. And then also have some tricks up your sleeve. One of those tricks might be to require your students to read the lesson before you teach it, but I'm getting off track perhaps in preparing for lessons. But let's make sure that the maxim, let it be said of our students, they have learned how to learn. Let's be sure that we work that into our preparation of lessons as well. We don't have to, and we should not tell the student everything. As important as preparation for classes is, our preparations must honor the principle that fat ducks will never fly. Like a lean, trim one, anyway. Another trick up your sleeve is stop if you're stuck. Don't continue to bumble around and prove to the class that you really don't know what you're doing. So the best thing you may do in some situations is just say, I'll be back tomorrow with this. And today all you have to do is the review part of the lesson. But we're going to double up on reading and so on. Have some tricks up your sleeve, an emergency backup plan and so on. Now some specific guidelines, how to study and prepare. Every lesson has objectives. Every lesson has takeaways, a term coined by Bruce Wilkinson in his book, The Seven Laws of the Learner, were minimums for mastery. Every lesson has minimums for mastery. Know those takeaways. Know those objectives. Every lesson has them, whether it's a skill-based or a content-based lesson. And then consider, what skills do we need to review so that we can do today's lesson, so that we can accomplish the objectives? Plan a lead-in. Oftentimes that is a review. Do enough of the student work yourself that you haven't mastered. Plan some age-appropriate demonstrations or explanations, and have the material available for the students to practice it so that you know whether or not you're done. How do you know when you're ready to teach? Well, when you as a teacher, as a preparer, can easily do the student work yourself, then you know you're prepared. That's one sign. When you know what you're going to do, back to those clearly defined objectives, and when you know how to do it, when you have a plan of action, when you have the necessary material around, when you have the props for math class and science class, the tests are ready, the quizzes are ready, your clipboards are loaded, when you can recall those objectives without looking too hard at the teacher's guide, it's a good indication that you're ready to teach. Some closing advice from William Carey, the father of modern missions. When asked the secret of his fruitful mission work in India, he replied, "I can plod. I can persevere in definitive pursuit. To this, I owe everything." There you have it. Plod, persevere in the definitive pursuit of lesson preparation, and to this, your teaching will owe everything.
Preparing for programs is something that I like to think about, and I suspicion that's why I got assigned the topic. But I enjoy talking about it. And when I was a teacher, I heard a quote from a comedian who like to pull public shenanigans, and he said, if you're going to make a scene, be seen. So I thought, if you turn that around, if you're going to be seen, make a scene. I think that's a good motto, humor removed, but a good motto for how we ought to plan for a program. You're going to have a program, so start planning ahead. I think you need to schedule when program practice is going to start instead of cramming it in like the last 2 weeks. Be prepared ahead of time. And you can be doing that during the summer. Sometimes I wonder why we aren't as prepared for programs when you had all summer. Always be looking for material that you can repurpose. That's part of planning ahead. Material that you're going to be going over anyway and you can use for your program. Can you use memory work that you're going to be doing at some point in the year and use that, incorporate that into your program? That's a pretty basic idea, but get you started thinking in the right direction. Search for the very best material. I replaced one of the years I taught. The plan that I put in place, I did Bible memory for the first half of the year up to Christmas vacation, and after Christmas vacation, we started program practice. If you're going to do that, you need to have good material that's worth memorizing. I think that's that's a side benefit of our programs, is that we get another chance to put something in children's minds that they'll remember for a long time. So make sure that you're using the very best material. Now, what is worth memorizing may depend on what you think and maybe even the setting that you're in. So some of the ideas I have might not be something you like, but the principle of getting something that you feel is of value is something that's you can bank on. A few ideas on places to search for the very best material. If you run out of good poetry or poetry that has depth, start looking in old hymnals. I bought a hymnal here on Amazon some time ago, and I really haven't paid much attention to the music so far. I've just sat down and read it as a poetry book, and that particular hymnal just has some incredibly rich poetry. So that's an idea. Look in old songbooks. I've also been successful searching for poetry online. Now, it will take you a fair amount of time, usually, but maybe you, or for me anyway, I would think, maybe I would remember a poem I heard. I'd start searching for it. Maybe you find an author, and you think, well, that was a good poem. What else did he write? So you look for an author, and it kind of is a chain. You go from website to website to website, and eventually I have found some good stuff, and I think I used at least one poem I found online in a program. One other idea, let me back up. Scripture is always worth memorizing, and so find creative ways to use that. But there's also some things that closely related to our scriptural doctrine and teaching that we can use. One of the things I did one year was had my students recite a major portion of the Dortrick Confession of Faith. So that's not scripture, but that is sound doctrine that is an excellent thing to be poking into their heads. All right, another thing that is good to be thinking about when you prepare for your program is how to connect with your studies. My opinion is that our programs don't do this enough. We memorize things, we sing, but you know the old stories you read about the schoolmaster and you know the one room school and what they did. It was geography exercises and all kinds of things about what they studied. I think we need to be working at putting that back into our programs. That's a good idea. A few ideas that I've heard about. I heard about a school that just this past year had their students tell stories from their history lessons. My wife's had some interesting ideas in the last 2 years that she taught. One year she had two girls that were studying Holland in their social studies, so they did a presentation about Holland on their program. Last year, she had a real interest in birds, and so at the program, they did a presentation about birds. So connect your studies. And finally, present creatively. There's a lot of ways you can do this, and I don't have time to give you all of my ideas. But one way is use a flannel graph. We don't see that much anymore. Again, an idea from my wife. She did a flannel graph of the creation story, and that was a great presentation. Use trivia. Ask interesting questions or tell interesting facts, and that's a great way to connect with your studies. Another thing that is a good idea is use voices creatively. Try to get your students to talk instead of recite if they're saying, like an essay or something. And another idea is just use the whole group to emphasize words. If you were reciting scripture, have one narrator, but the whole group say the important words. For instance, God is our refuge and strength. Have the whole group say the words refuge and strength as you go through that passage. I had a co-teacher that did that. It was a very effective way of presenting scripture. Programs are one of the few public relations opportunities our schools have. I think we need to do our best to make them worth watching.